I think it's really essential that we ultimately have a cheap, robust supply chain for artemisinin, and I personally don't really care where that comes from. You know, I'm obviously passionate about plants, but if we can ultimately produce it better, you know, in a yeast platform, then that's great, you know, and there's plenty of other things that plants are good at doing as well.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and some of the good things it can do for people and the planet. I'm Kevin Fulta, and today we're going to talk about the issues associated with treating malaria. And in particular, the compound artemisinin, which is a compound derived from a plant with a similar name. And we're going to be speaking with Professor Ian Graham. Dr. Graham is a fellow of the Royal Society, and he's also the Weston Chair of Biochemical Genetics at the University of York in York, England. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Graham.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm excited that you're here, too. I caught the vast majority of your talk at ASPB in Montreal, the American Society of Plant Biologists, and you were the opening talk of the keynote opening session, and it was so exciting to see this kind of convergence of plant breeding as well as molecular biology, biochemistry, and all around the problem of human health and the two examples that you gave. And today we'll talk about the first one, which is a remedy towards malaria. And can we start out by talking about malaria in general? How many people are affected? And really, where is the majority of the problem?
So malaria remains a very serious and sometimes fatal disease. And according to the World Health Organization, there was 216 million cases worldwide in 2016, which is a lot. That's decreased slightly, but obviously not enough. And in fact, in 2016, there was an estimated 445,000 deaths, and most of those were children from sub-Saharan Africa. It gives you an idea of the magnitude of the problem.
It's really interesting that we know so little and have so little awareness of this in the Western world, because I've seen that graphic where it talks about we worry about shark attacks, but so few of them happen, when really the mosquito is probably the most insidious killing animal on the planet.
Yeah, it's referred to as the biggest killing animal, as you say. I should just point out so that you're not ignorant of the fact, but there's something like 1,700 cases of malaria in the United States, which comes from travelers coming back from those countries where malaria is happening. So it's something to be concerned about everywhere in the world, and not just in those countries where people are suffering daily from it. The symptoms are severe. People go into shaking and chills, and they can come in and out of that. It's worse than people who have never been exposed to this to bites from mosquitoes. And so I say to my students, if they're going off in a gap year, that they need to be very, very careful, because if you haven't been exposed to malaria, then it can kill you. And that's why in sub-Saharan Africa, if children survive, and as I said, a lot of them unfortunately don't survive once they catch it, but if they do, they have some resistance which allows them to survive into adulthood. But then even if they have malaria and are suffering from it in adulthood, it's a huge load on society, because people are lethargic and, as I say, go in and out of sickness.
And the basis of this disease, like the pathology, is this all caused by a plasmodium, or what is the major, causal organism in the disease?
Yeah, it's caused by a plasmodium. In fact, there are four different species of plasmodium that are known around the world. The one that's most prevalent and the biggest killer is Plasmodium falciparum. And basically, it has a life cycle where it spends part of its life cycle in the mosquito, and then through biting humans and other animals, the mosquito transfers the parasite to your blood, and from there it can travel to the liver and change its form, and from the liver it goes back into the blood and then ruptures red blood cells. And it's that rupturing of red blood cells which can cause anemia and ultimately cause death, with ruptured red blood cells blocking your capillaries. So it's a horrible disease.
So what are the traditional ways in which it's treated?
So it's a classic, you know, arms race, the way that that medicines have been developed to treat malaria over the years. Quinine was one of the first treatments discovered and developed since the 1800s. But as with a lot of infectious diseases with parasites, there's this arms race that goes on, with the parasite developing resistance to the drugs, and then, you know, the pharmaceutical industry and biomedical researchers having to develop new drugs that the parasite hasn't got resistance to. And this goes on. It's similar in many ways to antibiotic resistance developing against bacteria. So we've had a number of drugs that have been developed. Going back, as we come on to talk about artemisia, that compound's been used in Chinese traditional medicine for several thousand years, and so there's, you know, human civilizations have found various ways to treat it, but unfortunately the parasite itself is also very smart and can evolve to get resistance to what we have discovered.
And what exactly is artemisia? Is this a so it's a plant that's been used in medicinal contexts, but what is it and where does it grow?
So Artemisia annua, to give it its full name, and that second part of the name, you know, emphasizes that it's an annual plant. It grows in China and Vietnam, and it produces frond-like leaves and produces a lot of biomass. In fact, you can get, you know, tons of biomass quite easily, and it produces glandular trichomes on the surface of the leaves. These are, you know, little glands similar to what you find on a mint plant that gives that wonderful mint flavor and aroma. And so these glands on the surface of the leaves are really small factories that are used by plants to produce a whole lot of different chemicals that they want to produce and you often use to fight off attack from other invaders of plant leaves and cells.
That's a really interesting point, because I think the listeners can maybe think about, you know, like you mentioned, the glandular trichomes, and you mentioned mint, but also on things like hops and other plants or other types of plants. These are these small little hairs that happen on the leaf, sometimes give it a rough feel, and they're in many cases used to provide a physical barrier of defense against insects, but also they produce a lot of very interesting secondary metabolites, meaning these compounds that are very specialized compounds that are not involved in the primary metabolic functions of the cell, but do something to enhance the survivability, whether it's something nutritionally or, in this case, a defense compound. So how was this stuff identified, though, and how was it first isolated?
So that's a very interesting story in itself. It was, as I said, known in Chinese traditional medicine for a couple of thousand years, and then during the Vietnam War, in fact, you know, there were more American soldiers and also Viet Cong dying of malaria than enemy fire, and so malaria is a huge problem, and to this day the U.S. Department of Defense, you know, does a lot of work on infectious disease for that very reason, that, you know, that armies in foreign countries can suffer from these infectious diseases. And so there was a program launched by Chairman Mao in China after he met with Ho Chi Minh during the Vietnam War to find a cure for malaria. And that led to a large group of Chinese scientists, pharmaceutical chemists, botanists, working on finding a solution, and they found reports in ancient Chinese medicine books referring to this plant Artemisia annua that was in Chinese traditional medicine, effectively in boiling water, that it could be used to treat people suffering from fevers. And one particular scientist called Yu Yu Tu, a very famous female scientist in China today, was recognized as being one of the key people who discovered that this plant was actually producing a small molecule, which he later defined as the compound. It's a 15-carbon sesquiterpene, so it's a terpenoid compound. And Yu Yu Tu won the 2015 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for discovering artemisinin, and I think that she's the first Chinese woman to win the Nobel Prize for work done in China. So it's a great accolade to that work. That was then all published and went into the public domain during the course of the 1970s. But it was only in the early 2000s that the World Health Organization really recognized that artemisinin could be used and recommended it to be used as the first-line treatment for people suffering from malaria.
But when you talk about the problem and the magnitude of the millions of people that are affected, how is there possibly enough of this artemisinin available to be able to treat that many people? And is it something that is in short supply, or do you have farms of this plant to grow it or produce it?
It's grown mainly in China. I think about 70% of the world's supply is produced in China. It's also grown in Madagascar and East Africa. It's farmed. It's by smallholder farmers, and you know they grow it under contract, typically with an extractor, on areas of land that are quite small, about an acre. So you can have thousands of smallholder farmers growing Artemisia. They cut it down and dry the leaf, and then the leaf is shipped off to the extraction factory for extraction of the drug. You know, it's like any other agricultural product in that, you know, the price can fluctuate, so that, you know, if there's lots of it grown one year, then there's lots available, and the price inevitably goes down. So you do get peaks and troughs in price of the drug. But the very interesting thing in the context of the plant or agricultural based production is that the work that we've done on the plant, which was funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation from 2006, was focused on improving the plant-based production, and we developed new F1 hybrids for that production. In parallel with that, the Gates Foundation funded a synthetic biology-based approach, which was led by Jay Keesling at Berkeley and the biotech synthetic biology company Amyris. And that was also very successful at taking the genes out of plants and putting them into yeast to produce not artemisinin, but a precursor of artemisinin called artemisinic acid. And so it's been an interesting approach, and to this day, it's still being optimized. The ultimate goal being that there will be an alternate supply of artemisinin that can bolster the plant based agricultural production in order to keep the price as low and as predictable as possible.
Well, that sounds really exciting. I think it's a great idea to be able to translate these things into microbes for enhanced drug production. So let's follow up with that a little bit on the other side of the break. We're speaking with Professor Ian Graham, who is a professor of biochemistry at University of York in the UK. And we're talking about artemisia and artemisinin, the compound that helps fight malaria, and new ways to enhance its production. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. As always, we're excited to deliver the exciting stories of how DNA-based technologies are providing new solutions for people all over the planet. We're learning more about who we are as a species, the life around us, and how we can produce better food for more people, with sensitivity to this big stupid rock in space that sustains us. This podcast is funded 100% by Kevin Folta, and comes to you free each week for your listening pleasure. We actively turn away advertisers that could defray the costs of this enterprise, because that would simply reinforce the beliefs of the whistleblowing merchants of doubt that believe education is simply a tentacle of corporate conspiracy. You can help by writing a review on iTunes, tell your friends, write a review on a blog, or leave some positive thoughts on the BuzzFeed article about me, Vern Blazer. Most of all, share the beautiful stories of science that you hear each week. And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast.
And we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast today, talking with Professor Ian Graham from University of York about Artemisia and Artemisinin, which is the plant and the compound associated with treatments for malaria. And before the break, we discussed what this was and what the problem was and what are some of the solutions. But now let's go a little bit more into the genes and metabolism and some of the ways that plants and microbes may have been or have been manipulated or enhanced to be able to produce these compounds. What are the pathways involved? I mean, where does this come off of primary metabolism?
I mentioned before the break that these glandular trichomes are used as factories for production, and most of secondary metabolism comes off primary metabolism, as you've said, and the for the whole of terpenoid metabolism, there's two possible routes in. One is through acetyl-CoA in the cytosol, which goes through the malevolent pathway, and there's another pathway which operates in plastids, which really comes from pyruvate, the so-called MEP pathway. And both of those pathways feed into the terpenoid biosynthesis pathway. And this pathway, it's building bricks of five carbon units, which are added on with each cycle. And so you go up to 10 carbons, which are monoterpenes, 15 carbons, which are sesquiterpenes, and 20 carbon units, which are diterpenes, and then so on into bigger numbers. And the artemisinin in itself is a 15-carbon sesquiterpene, and the substrate which feeds directly into that pathway is farnesyl pyrophosphate.
And that comes directly from mevalonate pathway, or, well, you mentioned before the two ways to do it, but that is
yes.
but that is something that can come directly from mevalonate as well, a mevalonate pathway.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of this around, it would seem, inside the plant, that this is a rather abundant, well, it feeds into many different pathways for secondary metabolism. So do you understand or do we know the specific enzymatic steps that allow the basic precursors to be transformed into artemisinin?
Yes. The great thing about these glandular trichomes as well is that these specialized enzymes, the genes encoding them, are only expressed in the glandular trichomes. They're not found in other leaf cells or root cells, for example. And the first committed step is a cyclization, where you take this 15-carbon FPP and you cyclize it to a compound called amorpha-411-diene, and the enzyme is amorpha-411-diene synthase, and that cyclizes the 15 carbons, and then, like most or all of secondary metabolism, once you get that carbon skeleton backbone, which usually involves ring-type structures, then there's a bunch of different enzymes involved in decorating the backbone, decorating it with hydroxyl groups or double bonds or additional methyl groups, for example. And it's that decoration which then leads to further alteration of the backbone and also the bioactivity that you find, the exquisite bioactivities that usually or often come down to protein small molecule interactions. So the entire pathway is well understood. In fact, there's a cytochrome P450 oxidase enzyme which carries out three or four subsequent oxidation reactions on that amorphous 411 diene structure, and then that can then be further reduced to a starting molecule in the plant, which is called dihydroartemisinic acid. And the really interesting thing about the pathway in plants, which we contributed to the demonstration and discovery of a couple of years ago in a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the USA, is that the last set of reactions are non-enzymatic, and they're carried out in planta by a photooxidative process. They need light in order for that those final reactions that lead to artemisinin, the molecule that kills the malaria parasite. And that molecule is a really unusual molecule in that it's got an endoperoxide bridge across one of the ring structures. And it's that endoperoxide bridge which can act as the warhead, as it were, to attack the parasite once it's taken into the blood. So in plants, it's a combination of biochemistry and then autocatalytic chemical conversion, and that raises an interesting point, because you know these glandular trichomes that have evolved over, you know, flowering plants have been on the planet for over 100 million years. So sometime during that, glandular trichomes have evolved, as I said, to help the plant fend off biotic and abiotic attacks. And these factories quite often have the ability to carry out both biochemical and chemical conversions.
And so if you help us understand this part, so if you think about the FPP as being the first compound and artemisinin being the last one, how many steps are involved in that process?
So it's about 10, yeah. 10 different steps. So I was saying the P450 carries out a couple of steps. I'm saying a couple because when it's going into artemisinin, it's two steps. When it's going to artemisinic acid, which is a pathway in yeast that will come onto it, it carries out an additional oxidation reaction, and then you get dehydrogenase reactions and reductase reactions, which are needed to produce this precursor to artemisinin, which is DHAA or dihydroxyartemisinic acid, and then you get a series of autocatalytic steps to produce artemisinin. And depending on how you split those autocatalytic steps, it can be 8 or 10 reactions to produce artemisinin.
Okay, so on that same continuum, if we think about, you know, the precursor to the final product, how many steps are already inherent in something like corn or soybeans that, you know, we grow jillions of acres of these? Is this something, that are most of those intermediates something that are present in other plants, or are these very specialized just to Artemisia?
No, that's a very good question. And in fact, they, you know, corn and all plants make lots of FPP, that precursor. But the pathway itself is completely specific to Artemisia annua. So it's a very specific cyclization reaction which is carried out by this enzyme amorpha 411 diene synthase. And quite often that's why these cyclization enzymes are very are very specific, and you find them in different species making different backbones for different activities. There will be other sesquiterpenes and diterpenes made in plants such as corn, but they will be different to artemisinin.
Yeah, so it all goes back to that same sesquiterpene backbone, but different decorations and different ways that that backbone might be bent and cyclized. That's pretty much it?
Yeah.
So if you did decide to move this to something like, bacteria or yeast, as we mentioned earlier, how difficult is it to really move a very specialized set of metabolic steps into a single-celled organism?
The first thing is there's a few things that you need. The first thing is you need the genes, because if people think about synthetic biology, then, genes are the currency of synthetic biology, and you need the genes encoding the proper the right enzymes to make whatever you want. So that's one of the first things you need. You need a really good supply of that starter substrate, which is FPP, that we were talking about, that is cyclized. And some companies now have done a really good job in baker's yeast or brewer's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, to engineer the basic metabolism in those yeast to make, bucketfuls of FPP. And not just FPP, but the adding on another five carbons to GGPP, and so those platforms for synthetic biology have really advanced and developed in recent years. Amaris are a very good example of having done that. That's not all you need, because as I was saying, the case with artemisinin and what makes it a real challenge for synthetic biology is, that it's not just biochemical enzymatic steps that are responsible for its production. Those last steps, from DHAA, which is completely inactive, dihydroartemisinic acid is completely inactive against the malaria parasite. And in fact, the other thing is that artemisinin itself is quite cytotoxic, so a yeast cell isn't going to be very happy producing something which is phytotoxic. So, and this is the case with lots of different compounds that we now want to make for the pharmaceutical industry or flavor and fragrance industry in bugs such as yeast, because quite often those molecules will have some toxic effects on single cells. And that's one of the other wonderful things about glandular trichomes on plants, because they've evolved to actually pump the final product out onto the surface of the glandular trichome. So there's a sort of hydrophobic droplet that's covered in a waxy layer on the surface of the glandular trichome, which can accumulate, and we think accumulate precursors to artemisinin, and then the chemistry, as it were, to produce this final quite toxic compound at high concentrations could even be happening on the outside the cells. And so there's exquisite transport of precursors outside the cell to get them outside the glandular trichomes as well. So I'm saying all that because then when you start making compounds like this in a single cell such as yeast, you have to think about transporting precursors out into the media, and how can you convert those precursors to the final product. So you need a really good host system, you need the right genes, you need to be able to do the right chemistry eventually, and you need really to be able to scale that up to large scale so you can compete with plant-based production, because ultimately for all of these projects, the final decision is made by economics, and where can you make it the cheapest. So it sounds straightforward, but it's often a very complicated process.
Well, let's revisit that thought about making this in plants. You mentioned your genetic improvement methods by using F1 hybrids from with Gates Foundation. How well does that work to increase your yields of the final product?
So we in the course of of our work using procedures such as mutagenesis, where we increased the genetic variation that we had available to us for, you know, fast-track molecular marker-assisted breeding, and also using natural variation that we had available to us and finding the best parents to make F1 hybrids using, you know, a combination of conventional approaches and marker-assisted breeding, we were able to get a really robust F1 hybrids. That's the great thing about hybrids, is that they grow fast and they're robust. That also had, you know, good biomass yields and higher concentrations of artemisinin per unit weight than we'd seen before. So we ended up, you know, field trialing our best hybrids around the world in China and Africa and India as well, although India really proved to be too hot for production. And we got significant increases compared to what was available for growers. And I'm really pleased to be able to say that in 2015, we, after a series of field trials in China by a government institute, they registered one of our CNAP hybrids for production in China.
Well, that sounds really good. I mean, is there any chance that American farmers could compete in this if they had the right conditions?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, it's one that I asked many times when you know, we were developing our hybrids as to, you know, could this be done on a sort of commercial farm scale, because you remember what I said, that you know, currently all of the Chinese-based production is still on relatively small scale in terms of the size of the farm. But, you know, you could have 20,000 farmers all growing small patches of land producing the plant. I think the technology, there's still a lot of labor involved, and you know, the technology hasn't been developed to harvest and get dried leaf and to take that to the factory. So to this day, I think basically, again, it comes down to economics. It's relatively small scale farming, and you know, I'm not aware of any sort of commercial scale farms for production. And you know, they ultimately as well, what you have to remember is that, you know, the plant is really good at producing the drug. You know, you get enough treatments from 1 to 2 acres to treat, you know, thousands and thousands of people. So ultimately, the actual acreage overall is relatively low to sort of scale up to commercial scale farming.
Yeah, I'm not interested in taking food from the mouths of folks in the developing world and, you know, and limiting their production of a valuable crop. But I know here in the state of Florida, there's a lot of interest in diversification, especially in things that could be very profitable in a smaller acreage. And sure. And even organic growers and others who have plenty of good farming skills but are always faced with everybody selling the same crops. And in a state where we have a lot of land where citrus used to grow, turning into neighborhoods and malls, keeping that in agriculture would be great. And so I always have to ask the question. But in addition to your efforts with the hybrids, are there ways to genetically engineer plants to maybe take out a rate-limiting step or two to increase the level of artemisinin in the individual plants?
Yes, it's another good question, and there have been a number of examples where that's been successful. One of the ones that I like the most, in fact, is a group of Spanish and Chinese scientists who work together to introduce a transcription factor which alters the number of trichomes that are formed in the leaves, on the surface of the leaves. And that alone had a significant impact on close to doubling, from what I recall, the amount of artemisinin And this was all done under glasshouse conditions. So that's one example where you can increase the number of glandular trichomes. Another group out of China have recently demonstrated, in combination with publishing the first draft of the Artemisia annua genome, that they can introduce a bunch of those genes that are involved in the biosynthetic pathway for the synthesis, and they can also see a significant increase compared to a wild-type control. And when I was asked to comment on that work, I think it's very elegant genetic engineering work, but you know, if you now reflect on the regulatory processes which will need to be followed, this is a Chinese traditional medicine, and one of the plants that the Chinese are probably most proud of, given that one of their scientists has recently won the Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine. And the need now would be to do comprehensive field trials to demonstrate that those yields are upheld in the field, and then to get regulatory approval to grow those plants in the field. So I have no objections to that at all, but looking at it pragmatically, I think it'll be a few years before you would see GMOs being released for production.
It really is an interesting question, because do you think that anti-GMO interests, like folks like even Greenpeace or other organizations, which do claim to have a very developing world sensitive, socially sensitive ethic, that they would be opposed to GE-derived artemisian?
You know, I haven't debated that with them, but I would absolutely not be surprised if they were opposed to it, because they're opposed, you know, on a, you know, it's an ideology that they're opposed quite often to the use of GMOs, and I don't see a difference. I don't see them having a different view. I would like to think they would have a different view, but I can't see it happening.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think that, you know, food is medicine in a lot of ways, especially when it's biofortified, and people don't have a whole lot of tolerance for those technologies. And it really is sad, but probably a better example. And I really like that we were able to discuss this today, because it helps me be more agile as a communicator. I think it really is an excellent example of how genetic engineering of yeast or genetic engineering of the plant gets us around a lot of the problems that can come from smallholder farmers on limited scale using plants that maybe don't necessarily produce enough all the time. It's a really interesting question that shows the social edges of a scientific question, and I'm really glad we had time to talk about it. So some of the work was sponsored by Gates Foundation. And is that really typical of them to fund this kind of work? And how do you feel about their maybe long-term commitment to this project?
Now, that's a very pertinent question as well. I think it was quite visionary of the Gates Foundation. A way back, I think it was 2004, when they first thought of a technological fix to, you know, deliver a better supply of artemisinin into the supply chain. So ultimately, you'd have cheaper medicine and you would cure more people who are suffering and dying from malaria. And you know, they first funded this semi-synthetic route, where we've talked about the production in yeast, and then myself and a colleague from York, Professor Diana Bowles, approached the Gates Foundation and said, "Look, you know, as well as doing this in yeast, there's a lot can be done on plants as well to improve them." And they were open to that suggestion, and ran the two parallel projects to improve the supply chain for artemisinin, and I think that's been a good thing, because as we've seen, you know, it's been challenging to get microorganisms to produce compounds like this, and we've learned a lot along the way, and I think it's really essential that we ultimately have a cheap, robust supply chain for artemisinin, and I personally don't really care where that comes from. You know, I'm obviously passionate about plants, but if we can ultimately produce it better, you know, in a yeast platform, then then that's great, you know, and there's plenty of other things that plants are good at doing as well.
Yeah, we can switch to solving other problems, right? So, Professor Ian Graham, if people wanted to learn more about this project or more about your laboratory, what's the best place for them to find that information?
The best place is we've got a dedicated website to the Artemisia project, and I'll provide you with that, and maybe it can be shown along with the podcast.
Yeah, that's perfect. I'll put it on the website here. So thank you very much for joining me, and we'll join you again in the future and talk about opioids. That really looking forward to that, too.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Learn the story of artemisinin and learn how it helps millions of people all around the world and how new efforts to engineer those plants or engineer microbes could have profound effects on world health, especially in places where people have less health security. I'm Kevin Folta. Thank you for listening to the podcast, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.